A lot of Jews who are not Ashkenazi will say, I'm Sephardic, because in America it's become like a pan-ethnic identity, as a minority identity.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Shai Davidai.
This season of Here I Am with Shai Davidai is dedicated to the memory of my grandmother, Savta Leah Davidai, who passed away earlier this year. Here I am with Savta Leah in mind.
So before we begin, I would like to thank our Patreon supporters, who many of them are watching us live as we record this, one of the many perks of being a Patreon supporter of our podcast. My guest today is wears many, many, many hats, and I actually had to write them down just to make sure that I remember all of them. She's a Torah teacher. She's a sociologist of American Jewry. She's the host of the podcast Wandering Jews, a scholar in residence in the Maimonides Fund, and a co-founder of the Downtown Minyan in New York City. And here I am with Michal Biton.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Shai, for having me. Really and excited for this.
I have to tell you, when I prepare for these episodes, a lot of time I read different interviews that people give. I watch their videos. With you, it was a bit different. I read a lot of what you've written. Mm. And there's so many things I want to talk about. I have to say I'm a little bit intimidated. It's just, you're incredibly, incredibly insightful. But before we begin and delve into everything, I want to ask you, Michal, what kind of a Jew are you?
Oh, what a question to start with. I don't know what you mean by that question. I would say, and I'm saying that as a way to answer. I don't think that I walk around thinking that I'm one type of Jew. Mm-hmm. I'm a Jew. Who I am.
Do you, does your Jewish identity come into focus in one way or the other in your life?
So it's funny. I actually wrote a piece, you spoke about my writing, critiquing the idea of identity. Because often when we speak about Jewish identity, there's a way of discussing it almost as like a hat that you wear and you can take off. So it's like, right now, is your Jewish identity coming out? Is it not coming out? How does it intersect with other hats? And that's not how my parents raised me. My Judaism is less a hat that I wear and can take off, and is more the tradition from which I emerge. There's no time that I can take it off or think of myself in any way that is separate from being Jewish.
It's an interesting thing because especially in Western culture and in the United States, it's like perfected the idea of the hyphenated identity. You're American Jew. Or Jewish American, or whatever you want to, however way you want to order it, but that implies that you're both Jewish and American, but also that there are parts of you that are solely Jewish and parts of you that are solely American, and it sounds like you are going against that hyphenated identity to begin with.
We all use the word identity in different ways, so I'm not here, bashing it or saying we shouldn't. Use it, but I am saying that for many individuals, to be a Jew in America has become something you can choose to emphasize and have or not have at different points. And I'm offering a competing way to think about it, that to be a Jew is not an identity that I wear. It's just the place that we come from and that shapes who we are. The best metaphor, Shai, that I have for this and that I have thought about is just the idea of family, right? So we can speak about what's like your identity as a mom, as a dad. And you can also say that, I'm a mom, mm-hmm. and you're a dad, and this is who you are. And even when you're not thinking about it, it's who you are.
Interesting. So it's almost like your family name, and it goes with you. I'm Shai Davidai when I'm a father, when I'm a son, when I'm a husband, when I'm a professor, when I'm a podcaster. That's my name. That's who I am. So, we're Jewish. And you mentioned the article. So I assume you're referring to the article, I'm Not a Jew of Color.
No, this was a different one that I wrote for Jewish Priorities beforehand based on my academic work. I wrote it just critiquing a little bit the idea of Jewish identity in a specific way. The other article you're mentioning was specifically around the category of Jew of color.
Right. So because there you really critique the idea of identity that tries to separate different Jews into different kind of categories.
Let me just take advantage and be clear about it, because I received a lot of feedback on that article. So I want to be clear. What I wanted to do is show how the category of Jew of color, which many people use and they should use if they find it meaningful.
By the way, what for people that are listening and may not know the label, what is Jew of color when people refer to that?
Because right.
Your article is about that, so right. What is it?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Yeah. So I described how in the last few years this term emerged, Jew of color. And I describe how one particular effort, and there's others, so just one effort, basically used this category to describe any Jew who was not white and or Hispanic and or white and other identities. So they constructed this, like, I know it sounds a bit technical, but the effort was based on this technicality. So they constructed this really wide umbrella that basically said, we're going to take all, like, Asian Jews, okay? Jews who write other because they're Middle Eastern. Black Jews, Hispanic Jews, including Hispanic Jews who are also white, which the majority of them are in America. We're going to put in this category any Jew who doesn't, you know, who puts other because they don't feel comfortable with saying white. I don't know how you identify, for example. And then that was used to describe this really broad category of Jew of color. And I argue that the way that it was constructed, without really checking in with all those groups that were kind of put into it, was part of an effort that I believe was divisive and unnecessarily so in terms of how we think of ourselves as Jews. So I'm happy to dig more into that if you want.
I would love to. I think there's a quote that there's many quotes in that article, but one that really touched me because it helped me understand myself a bit more. You say there, Jewish history disrupts simplistic frameworks of race and power. And I thought it was very interesting because for me, I don't feel like I fit into this white, non-white distinction. Of course, I'm white passing. If I'm walking down the street and no one sees my Magen David, or even if they do, they treat me as white or may treat me as white. I get the privileges of being treated as white. But that's not who I am. That's not my identity. So what is that? What is this Jewish history that disrupts the framework?
Yeah. So, Shoshai, what I was referring to there is that in America, especially in the last decade or so, the discourse around race and around justice really took on a very binary way of thinking and was very... It was a discourse that tied sociology and history with what I would describe as ideology, okay? And it's a discourse that basically said, in general, not just Jews, but in general, in America, you can kind of think about white Americans, and then you can think about people of color, and specifically Black Americans, and you can describe certain forms of oppression and power and privilege. And what happens is that when you study the history of Jews in America, we just don't make sense. Not only in terms of like the individual encounters we might have, in terms of how we identify or things like that, but in terms of the discrimination that we endured historically, in terms of the oppression that we endured, in terms of the things that we achieved in different ways, in terms of being on the one hand, have very high social mobility and still be the one of the highest groups who are targeted in terms of like hate crimes. So we just like mess up all these categories. And it's not only in America right now, part of the reasons that Jews have often been targeted is that we mess up neat ideological ways of looking at history. Hmm. We just don't make sense. And very often societies, like you want things to make sense or you want to be able to make certain statements about the world. And when Jews stubbornly, you know, confuse paradigms, it causes disruption. And that to me is part of what I saw in the discourse around racial justice And I'll just say, and let me say this like super clearly, this is not a way of saying that there isn't an important conversation we need to have around race and racism in America, especially around the experience of Black Americans. It is critical that we have it. We should also not walk away from the conversation around what it means to fight for belonging and inclusion for every single Jew in our community, because there is still discrimination, prejudice, and racism, and we need to address that. But I really believe, Shai, that we have to do it without giving up on our stories. We are unique. We are inconvenient. We mess up binaries. That's who we are.
But what about a lot of American Jews would say, I don't understand the problem. You know, I'm Ashkenazi Jew. I'm white. I'm Mizrahi or Sephardic Jew. I'm not white. Why do we need to disrupt? Why can't we just assimilate our, you know, the way we see ourselves, the identities, the self-proclaimed identities into society's categories?
Yeah, first, let me just say something, Shai. I wouldn't necessarily say that Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews aren't white. Mm. I actually think that's a conversation we need to have. And Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews and communities are really diverse and varied. And also, not all Ashkenazi Jews are white. So that's just in terms of like the empirical reality. We need to interrogate that. The surveys don't show that. They point to something else. But I think, Shai, what I was pushing against in terms of their article, it was more saying we have been almost like responding to different forces in America by giving up parts of our story. So I'm not saying that I want to actually impose a problem, right? Or I'm just saying we responded to it in a way that wasn't the right way to respond. And maybe I'll give some examples. So I had been part of many interfaith, intergroup, interracial, interethnic kind of conversations. And there were often like assumptions around or narratives around like, I'm being simplistic, you know, for the sake of being simplistic, like, you know, like white, Ashkenazi, powerful Jews who like, we're going to put them in the category of oppressors. And then assumptions about like Sephardic, Mizrahi, non-white Jews oppressed, and assumptions around inherent racism. So that's what I'm pushing against. We cannot, number one, be okay with the distortion of truth. Facts matter. Data matters. We should not move our, surveys to say things that are not honest. And beyond that, who we are as Jews and our experiences, even if they are tricky and complicated, that matters as well.
So it's interesting because I 100% agree with you. Although I got there for a different point. You obviously came here through data and logic. And for me, it was just like a feeling. I recently posted something on social media that I became white in 2010 when I moved to the US. Mm. I've never thought of myself as white. But when I moved to the US, I was 27 and I accepted this category that was imposed on me and really drank the Kool-Aid. And then I stopped being white on October 7th, 2023. And I wrote about this and explained that for me, you know, I really took on the social construct, but because it's a social construct, you can also take it off. And the reaction from the, let's say, the social media world was shocking. People were pushing back and saying how the Jews, you know, using me as the Jews, right? The Jews try to have it both ways. They're trying to enjoy the benefits of appearing or passing as white while also saying they're not white. Being the oppressor while also, you know, using the quote-unquote victim card and oppressed. How do we have that conversation that is so important without creating all that backlash?
I don't know if you can avoid the backlash. Because what you are demanding is to have a more complex and honest conversation. And as you know, social media is not the best suited for that. So I'm not sure if we can have a way to not have backlash to something complex and honest. But I think what your reflection, which I think is so powerful, Shai, of what it means to experience that, I think if I was having a conversation not on social media, okay, like a real, honest conversation with folks who wanted to understand, and I want to bring right now, Shai, I didn't see that feedback, but let's think for a second, what's the most generous version of the pushback? Okay?
Right.
The most generous version of the pushback would be to say, hey, listen, okay, you've experienced some anti-Semitism, some discrimination, but if you just look at socioeconomics and if you look at, the way that Jews are in America and you compare them to minority groups that have been historically disadvantaged, then it's, you know, how can you say that you are not white, right? So that would be like the most generous version of the critique.
Although that kind of critique would almost explicitly state when we say white or non-white, what we really mean has nothing to do with pigment, has nothing to do with skin. It has to do with class, education, etc.
Yeah, but they would also the most extreme manifestation of that discourse would also essentialize race. It would say it doesn't really, even if you're very white passing, but you come from a certain place, you can still hold on to that racial and ethnic identity. But to your point, have you watched the Netflix show The Queen's Gambit?
I've not, no.
Okay, but what's the name of the actress? Do you remember? Can you imagine her?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. So if you can imagine her, we can put the name later if we remember. There was this controversy around her that I always bring up as an example and I always forget her name. Because some big magazine gave the actress an award as a woman of color. Now, when you think of her, is she a woman of color?
I don't know.
She's like the palest.
Yeah.
But she was born in Argentina. So part of what you're pointing out is that there is this like American kind of like thinking of race that is absolutely absurd because they take people from all of these countries that are super diverse. And I can tell you, Argentina has its own race dynamics. In Argentina, you have your way of talking about what it means to be white or people of color. Like there's all of these layers there. But in America, the racial discourse, often in progressive spaces, has been so shallow that you take everybody from South and Central America and you're like, well, you entered America just like you entered here from Israel. You are now a person of color. So I think that there is such an inadequate ability to hold complexity, okay, and to even hold like a sophisticated way of thinking that race has context and that it's different in different places, and that backlash is because people cannot look at Jews and they cannot understand that we have often experienced both power and vulnerability simultaneously. That is a Jewish experience. It's been the Jewish experience historically. That we've had both, and we've also like experienced so clearly what it's like to lose power and safety, you know, so quickly. So we are aware of that, but I think there's just like an allergy to maintain, you know, multiple ways of thinking.
But do you think it's that people have a difficulty of holding these complex identities, or an unwillingness? Because it seems, especially in the past decade in progressive circles in the U.S., that there's been a move towards more complexity, more intersectionality, more attention to not necessarily what someone appears to be, but what someone identifies as. And yet that complexity or that willingness to hold complexity seems to evaporate when it comes to Jews.
Yeah, I mean, I would disagree with you, though. I don't think there's been a move towards more sophisticated complexity. I think very often it's been, I think there's a lot of, you know, I, as an example, I spent like maybe 6 months reading up like critical race theory, and I wanted to like read the academics, you know, not just the op-eds on it. And on the one hand, you read it and you say, well, this is really like complex. On the other hand, you can read it quickly and say, this is, there's also something here that is very not profound and that does not conceive of multiple ways of thinking about the world. So I would say that there is a semblance of complexity that very often comes with shallowness of thinking.
Interesting, because one of the things that have really affected me was when people around me, people that I trusted or thought that I trusted, were refusing to accept my self-identification as white passing Jew. Like, they would say, no, you're white. You're Jewish, but you're white. And said, well, no, I look white. I appear white, but Jews predate your categories. I'm Jewish. And I felt and still feel that many identities that you would never even dare question when it comes to gender and sex and race in many ways in the U.S., if you come and say, I am Jewish, I am not white, I'm Jewish, I'm not black, I'm Jewish, I'm not whatever, people push back and say, no, you don't get to define. Is that unique to us Jews, or is there something deeper there?
I mean, I think, I would say that Jews have been exceptional in that in many times and places we have messed up with categories. If you read, there's one of the best books that I've read that helped me understand anti-Semitism has been David Nirenberg's book called Anti-Judaism, mm-hmm. In which he describes how it's not about anti-Semitism, it's about what he describes as anti-Judaism, which is what happens when forces in society identify what is wrong in their society or what they oppose as Jewish. Right. So they for Marx, right, the capitalist is the Jew. So that's a way to think about like anti-Judaism, that what you don't like, what you're opposing, you describe it, you know, by describing it as Jewish. And part of the reason that anti-Judaism has been able to flourish is, again, because Jews have always, we have just always messed up with easy categories, right? We have stubbornly confused people. And when we do that, we're almost like an easy target. At the same time, to your question, Shai, I am a critic of the discourse around race and ethnicity and identities in progressive and academic spaces, not just because I am a Jew. I am a critic because I have certain, I hold up to certain ways of thinking born out of like classical liberalism. And I see a lot of inconsistencies and intellectual either mistakes or wrong ways of thinking that I oppose. So I'm coming to this both as a Jew who wants to defend the right of Jews to be different and to share our stories and identities, even when they are complicated. And I also come to this as, you know, we spoke at the beginning, different identities, but I also come to this as like a thinking person. And I'm like, there's a lot of messed up ideas here that are wrong.
Yeah, it's. I think that's the affinity that I immediately experience when reading your work, where in many ways we are different. You know, you are you'd consider yourself more orthodox. I know the category. We'll talk about those categories, but more, you know, you're observant, religious woman. I am an atheist, secular man. But in other ways, we're very similar, and maybe it's the affinity because we're both come from academic world and the importance of like, let's look at the data, let's look at the numbers, let's look at reality, which brings me to another hat that you wear. You're the director of the national study, I think the first national study of Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews in the U.S. Tell me about that study.
Yeah, I don't know when this podcast will air, if it will be out yet or not, but it should be out very soon. So we're very excited. I spent the last 3 years directing an amazing group of researchers and academics across the world, actually, who decided to gather together and study Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews. And maybe I'll tell you a little bit why I did it, Shai. There was actually a formative moment for me when I started grad school. I attended this symposium, this like big conference, and one of the, I'm not going to say his name, but one of the foremost experts of Jewish history was giving a presentation. And he was describing...
You realize everyone will be Googling now.
No, they won't find it. No, don't worry. Yeah. But he had this like big whiteboard, and he was like a 2-hour like sweeping, exhilarating like survey of like Jews and Judaism and what we did and the options ahead of us. And literally I was sitting there and I was nodding and I was enjoying. And like, you know, when like you're sitting in a lecture and you're thinking, okay, where is this going to go? What are they going to cover? And I assumed, as a matter of fact, that he was going to bring in the experiences and histories of Jews from the Middle East and North Africa and how they have shaped modern Judaism and what possibilities they give us to think with. And I thought it was like obvious that he was going to get there. Right. And then like the lecture ends and I'm like, wait a second. I'm like, half of Jews in Israel come from the Middle East and North Africa. There's huge, strong, vibrant communities all around the world. And this is not for me about, it's not only about, let me make this clear, Shai. I am not coming from this only from a place of like inclusion is important. Don't exclude big groups. From a point of thinking about who we are and who we can be, of learning about what we have built, of learning what are different forms of Judaism and Jews, the entire project gets impoverished when we don't understand each other. So that experience was one of the things that led me to focus my academic studies on Sephardic Jews, not for the sake of Sephardic Jews, as much as I love my communities, but for the sake of the Jewish people.
So just to understand, the talk mostly focused on quote-unquote Ashkenazi Jews and kind of glossed over.
Did not even gloss over.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And so you decided, let's put a, you know, magnifying glass and figure out what is the Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews.
Yeah. And what I'll tell you, Shai, and this happened in Israel also maybe 30 years ago, but there's been so many scholars there. Here, it's really new. We don't even have categories. Like, we have important scholarship, but we, if you are, the amount of emails that I get from rabbis, heads of schools, academics, who would tell me something along the lines of, we really want to talk about Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews. Where do I start? What does the word Sephardic mean? What does Mizrahi mean? What's the difference? How many are you? Are you Orthodox? What denomination do you fit in? Like a million questions. And the problem is that when you have a field that's been neglected, you don't even have the intellectual tools to begin exploring the questions. Mm-hmm. So this study is actually a first step. I really hope that there's many more studies. It's not exhaustive, but it's a first step to say, let's put together some of the most important intellectual building blocks to be able to begin understanding and exploring these populations.
So before we get to the maybe main findings or main ideas that come out of the study, maybe you can explain, because a lot of people listening and watching in, some may not even be Jewish, many are not Jewish, but even Jewish people don't really understand what is, you know, we have this view Ashkenazi is from Eastern Europe and that's, you know, then spread to Western Europe. But what is the difference between Sephardic Jews, Mizrahi Jews? What are the distinctions there?
Okay, I'll try. As you know, as an academic, like when you've done a ton of work on something, yeah, it's hard to get like that bit quickly. But before I even say it, I'll just remind all of us, categories evolve and change. And that's the first thing to remember. So Sephardic Jews are Jews who trace their ancestry to Jews who lived in the Iberian Peninsula in what we're going to call Sephardi medieval times. Sephardic Jews also include Jews who trace their practice. So at a similar time, there were almost like two centers of Jewish practice, Jewish law, Jewish customs. So I'm talking here about rabbis and philosophers who are writing and giving guidance in terms of practice. So that's when you have Sephardic and Ashkenazi. So to
where
be
were the centers?
Sepharad, so that's like a center in the Iberian Peninsula. And Ashkenazi was focused mostly in like France and Germany and different areas there. But those become almost like, it almost like Judaism developed two legitimate ways of approaching law and practice, right? So it's like you have the center on Sepharad, the center in Ashkenaz. So it's almost like, do you eat rice in Pesach or do you not eat rice in Pesach? Okay, or some other divisions that you have. Who do you follow? So to be a Sephardic Jew, it's either that your family came from there a long time ago, okay? My family, from my mother's side, came from there a long time ago, Or it's to say I am part of those communities that throughout time have adopted the practice, the philosophy of Sepharad. I'll just mention something here that makes this all tricky, Shai. We spoke about anti-Semitism and oppression after what's, you know, what many call the Golden Age of Spain. Effectively, Jews were expelled from Spain and then Portugal, and there was an Inquisition afterwards for the conversos who remained. So you have a history of Jews who lived in one of the most sophisticated and powerful centers, who ended up moving all around the world, especially to the Ottoman Empire, North Africa and the Middle East. So Sephardic tradition ends up going all over there. So as an example, and again, stop me if I'm doing too much.
No, I think it's great. And I think a lot of people will understand why Greek Jews from Greece, tend to view themselves more Sephardic, right? Because they came all the way from North Africa, all around the peninsula.
Right. Or I'll take my husband as an example. My husband's... his parents are Egyptian. They fled Egypt. His family comes from Iraq and Syria before Egypt. His family never stepped foot in Spain, unlike mine, okay? Never stepped foot there. But the Jewish community in Syria, okay, had a small group of Sephardic exiles who moved there after the expulsion. And eventually, with time, it said, we are Sephardic because we follow the Sephardic approach. Right? I'm going to just make two more, this, like, you know, make it a little bit more precise. One is that in America, you know, because labels evolve, so a lot of Jews who are not Ashkenazi will say, I'm Sephardic, because in America, it's become like a pan-ethnic identity, as a minority identity. So you might have Persian Jews, they have their own unique customs and ways of doing things. And many of them, not all, some don't do it, but many of them say, yeah, we're Sephardic because we follow Sephardic law. Follow, you know. Some would say, no, we are Persian. We don't want to join it. So that's Sephardic. The really messy and complicated place, and it's messy because, as you know, when activists get involved, everything gets messy, is the category of Mizrahi. Let me ask you, Shai, as an Israeli, when you have to say who Mizrahi Jews are, how do you define that?
You know, it's very, if you'd have asked me before October 7, when I was really just accepting the categories that were kind of like floating in society, I didn't see much of a difference. And only after October 7, when I felt the urge to learn more about me, us, who we are, I started delving in and I realized the difference. So I would say Mizrahi Jews are Jews that were expelled from the land in either First or Second Temple, but never made it to Spain. So stayed around Middle East and close of North Africa. So, yeah.
Okay, so I'll tell you how
the Babylonian Empire.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll tell you how I'm going to describe Mizrahi Jews and the way that maybe sociologists in Israel would describe Mizrahi Jews. So if we were to go in the 1920s, let's say, okay, or 1800s, to a Jew living in Morocco, or a Jew living in Tunisia, or a Jew living in Yemen, and we ask them, how do you identify? Well, they would think the question makes no sense. It's a very modern question. But if we were to push, okay, and explain to them what we mean, they would say, oh, I'm a Jew from Aleppo. I'm Halabi, okay? I'm from Tangier in Morocco. That's who I am. Maybe if you push, okay, I'm Moroccan, right? What do you follow? Okay, Sephardic halacha. It wouldn't be an identity. What ends up happening, and they would never say Mizrahi, what ends up happening in the 30s and really in the 40s and 50s is that you suddenly have hundreds of thousands of Jews from the Middle East and North Africa who for many different reasons either left or were expelled or fled or chose to immigrate to Israel. And in Israel, I'm going to simplify a little bit, but like the Ashkenazi majority looks at them. And there was a little bit of discrimination. I would say not a little bit. There was a bunch of discrimination there. And again, they look at them and they're like, we don't know how to differentiate between you. We can't differentiate between like the urban elite of Iraq and like the rural population in like different parts of Morocco. We don't know how to do this. You're all kind of like the same. You're all the Edot HaMizrach communities of the East. And they end up calling them Mizrahim, which is actually a derogatory term. Because back then, If you are not from the West, you are lesser than the West.
And the irony is that geographically, right, you know, if you come from Tripoli,
right,
you're more Western, right, than if you come from Ukraine.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yes, 100%. And also the irony is that they would turn to very often like incredibly educated Jews and treat them, because they spoke Arabic and French and not Yiddish, they treated them as really in a awful way. But I would say today, 2025, talking about Mizrahim, the term has been reappropriated by Mizrahi Jews, not as a derogatory term, but as a term of identity, of saying this is who we are. Today, about half of the Jewish population in Israel has some sort of Mizrahi ancestry, either fully or there's been a lot of marriage between different groups. And in Israel, Mizrahi and Sephardic overlap, right? Because Sephardic is the more religious term for the law and the custom that we follow. And Mizrahi has become this ethnic identity in Israel. And there's been, again, where it gets tricky, it's like there's been some bringing in of the Mizrahi story to America. So now in America, you have both terms and they work out differently.
So what are some of the key findings of the study?
Well, I'm excited for everyone to read it. Maybe we can link to it in the show notes. So many findings that I encourage everybody just to read the report or the executive summary. Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews in America, and I'm going to use both terms, comprise about 10% of the Jewish population in the United States. So they are roughly as big as Orthodox Jews or as Russian-speaking Jews. Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews are diverse. They live in different geographic areas. They identify differently in terms of race. So you have many who just say other, many who say white, many who say they are Middle Eastern, but there's no option in the census for that. Many who are also Hispanic. They are kind of like all over the place. Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews, Shai, and I don't think this would surprise you, but they are more than other Jews really connected to Israel, more than other Jews connected to a sense of observance. And in terms of our interviews that we did, Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews really value community. They value family. For them, doing Jewish is not what happens like in institutions as much as it is what happens around the Shabbat table. So we have a lot of these kinds of findings, and we paid particular attention in our qualitative work. We looked at what I described as immigrant communities or communities shaped by recent immigration. So Syrian Jews, Bukharian Jews, Persian Jews, Hispanic Jews in South Florida. And we tried to explain how much of the vibrancy that we see today in Sephardic communities really comes together with like a recent migration story to America and a very much holding on to identity.
Can you explain, so for a lot of people, if they've ever met a Jew in the United States, and most people haven't, but if they have, they probably have met an Ashkenazi Jew, and which makes sense because you said 10% are identified as Mizrahi Sephardic Jew. And yet, if I'm not mistaken, the first Jews to arrive to the U.S. were Jews from Portugal, meaning that they were Sephardic Jews. So how did we get to the point where the emblematic Jewish identity in the U.S. is almost synonymous with Ashkenazi, yet historically Sephardic Jews were the ones that started the...
The 23 first Jews to arrive in America were Sephardic. And also the kind of like a lot of the elite, the Jewish elite at the founding of America and in colonial times were Sephardic Jews. Emma Lazarus, for example, right, who wrote the famous poem in the Statue of Liberty, she was a Sephardic Jew. I think it's pretty kind of like natural because of migration history. There were kind of like millions of Jews from Eastern Europe who came, you know, at the turn of the century and who just swelled in numbers so much that they became really kind of like the face of American Jewry. And also a lot of the communities that I'm describing, I had a particular focus on communities from the Middle East or from other Muslim majority environments. Those came more recently. And some of them, not everybody, tend to be a little bit more insular. So when you build like an ethnic community in a neighborhood, right? Think about like an ethnic enclave, like the Syrian community in Brooklyn, right? Mm-hmm. So you, in some ways, you build something very potent and very strong. And in some ways, you stick with yourself more than other Jewish communities. So that might be part of it. But also some people, like Seinfeld, I think, is half Syrian. So there's been a lot of Sephardic Jews that perhaps don't wear that on their sleeves.
I don't think of Seinfeld as particularly right. Syrian Jew.
Right, right.
Which also complicates the things because it, if I'm not mistaken, comes from the father's identity, right? So if Ashkenazi woman and Sephardic man marry, typically the kids identify as Sephardic, right?
Right. So yeah, it's funny, Shai, because you're bringing like the Orthodox perspective around what customs you follow in Jewish law if you have marriage right. from different sides. I can bring my own feminist Orthodox perspective to this, but I'll just say that I think when it comes to like ethnic identification, it's a bit more messy. So people are not thinking so much, you know, about where it comes from. But Shai, let me just say something here that I think is like swimming in so much of our conversation. There is a difference between being born to a group or having ancestry and between like having that shape who you are, right? There's a huge difference there. Like we can talk about what it means to be a Jew just in terms of being born, right, to a Jewish parent. If you're Orthodox, it's matrilineal. We can go in different denominations. And between what it means to actually embody that, I'm not giving like a narrow prescription. I mean to walk with a sense of saying, this place that I come from, this community I come from, this tradition I come from, it shapes me. It obligates me. The famous philosopher Alasdair MacIntyre, who wrote about, you know, he was a communitarian philosopher, but he wrote about morality, what it means to be a human, as a need to ask ourselves, what stories have I been born into? How do they obligate me? And that to me is what we should aspire to as Jews. And Shai, your answer and my answer might and should actually be different. That to me, what's divine about all this, they should be different answers. But we should be asking this question, right?
So what is the answer for you?
The answer of how it obligates me?
Yeah.
For me to be a Jew is to be part of an extended family across time and space. And I feel, I don't want to just use obligation because I love my family so much. There's something there that I'm just like passionately in love with the Jewish people. And I feel obligated to act for the well-being of my people.
I have no problem with using the word obligation. In fact, you know, if you ask me about my kids, you know, I love them dearly. They're the most important thing in my life. But I'm also obligated to them. Like, even if I did not love them, I would behave exactly the same way as I do because I'm obligated to them.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to bring in also the love. Like you said, I love my kids and I'm obligated to them. So I'm like, I love my people and I'm obligated to them.
So I think that's a great point to get to another, it's a very important article that you published in Sapir Journal. It's just a great, great title. The pain you're feeling is peoplehood. Explain that. Why did you write that? What is that pain?
Yeah, so Shai, right after October 7th, I mean, even the morning of, that came to me because I was in shul, I lead a synagogue, and it was Simchat Torah, and I came into shul, I observed a holiday, so I didn't have a phone, and a congregant pulls me aside, like telling me the news, and I'm like, and I felt this, I mean, I'm sure we can all remember, but it was, I felt like my body was breaking. Like I was like, literally I have never felt such visceral pain in my life as I was hearing news of what was happening. And I wasn't alone. I'm like looking all around me and I'm like, everyone's feeling this. We're all feeling this. And it was such an out of body experience in the sense of never feeling that before, that extreme pain. And I had to figure out, what am I sharing with my people right now? And it just, something came to me that I had been teaching before, but I had been teaching it as something we need to consider. Like, we need to consider what it means to be a Jewish people. We need to consider our obligation to each other, especially in light of pain. And at that moment, I didn't want to say, consider this. I wanted to say, pay attention. You're feeling this right now. You're feeling this. And the reason you're feeling this, and I went to a teaching of Rabbi Soloveitchik, the reason you're feeling this is that the organism is working. If we wouldn't be broken up right now, and like literally like that physical viscera, like my body is breaking, it would mean the organism wasn't alive. And Shai, I kept sharing that message.
What is your organism?
The organism is the Jewish people as a family. It's that when your sister, when your cousin, when your fourth cousin that you have never spoken to, not just they're in pain, but they are being attacked because they are part of your family. When that happens, you feel it. You feel it. You are in pain. And if you cry, it means it's working. If you don't cry, it has been broken. And Shai, what blew me away is that it wasn't only the individuals in my shul that, you know, is observant to some level, but pretty diverse. It was, I kept going out and meeting Jews, secular Jews, Reform Jews, conservative, all over the map, politically all over the map. And the pain was there. And part of me just felt like we had been in a moment in America in which many Jewish leaders and institutions had assumed that we had lost that muscle. Post-ethnic Judaism. They assumed we needed to build a different type of American Jewish community. And here was such a manifestation that we had this, and I wanted to give language to this, and I wanted to tell people, when you feel this pain and it hurts and we are mourning and we are crying, but hold on to it. Understand that it calls on you to commit yourself to your family. And I mean, last week I spoke about this in Minneapolis, 2 weeks ago in Toronto, 3 weeks ago in Atlanta. Like, Jews are still, even nearly 2 years after October 7th, the organism is still working. And for me, this is nothing less than a call to us American Jews to tell us, these nerves that you thought had atrophied are alive. And you better not squander this moment and double down on what it means to think of yourself as a Jew who's part of a Jewish people and part of a family.
And what really amazed me in that article, and I recently reread it, is that you make an bright, incredible, logical argument. But then you bring in the Talmud. And
the Talmud is not illogical.
Of course. I mean, in the sense, not that it's not illogical, but then you bring in like the piece could have held without the Talmud, and yet the story that you bring from the Talmud takes it from good to great. Mm. Would you be willing to share that story from the Talmud?
Yeah, tell you, Shai, this is the way I think that I approach the world. I believe Torah is now, and Torah is ours, and Jewish wisdom and the world must be in constant conversation with each other. And that's something I learned from my parents and from Rabbi Sachs, who was a teacher of mine when he was in New York. But Rabbi Soloveitchik, he gave a series of sermons after Israel was established, and each of them is a precious stone. And they were written at such a complicated time. You know, he had studied in Berlin. He just saw the destruction of European Jewry, the lowest time, and then the State of Israel. So all of the sermons really carry gravitas. And in one of these, he asks a foundational question. He says, you know, he asks, can we still speak of ourselves as a Jewish people? Let me explain, and I'm going to use my own words, not his. But like, we are so diverse. We live in different countries, speak different languages, believe or not believe, reject or not reject the same God, Jewish law. It's like, is there a point, Shai, in which our diversity is so extreme that you and I cannot say we anymore. Right? That we're so dispersed. We have come to not know each other so much, become alien to each other. And then he answers with a Talmudic parable. There's a place in Talmudic discussions in which, you know, and the rabbis are lawyers who argue over so many things, including hypotheticals, and in this case, a fantastic hypothetical. And the rabbis in the Talmud ask, you know, let's say we're learning Torah, Jewish wisdom, in the house of study, and suddenly someone, suddenly somebody walks in, and we look over, and it's a man, but he looks different. He has two heads. And, you know, Shai, you and I, if we had this question, we might have a million questions for this two-headed man. But of course, the rabbis in the Talmud, they are like, well, should this being wear one pair of tefillin or two? Okay? Should this being, in terms of inheritance law, inherit once or twice? Like, it's pretty hilarious, the questions.
It's actually a very important, epistemological question. Is this one being or two beings?
It's an existential question.
Right.
Yeah. Spiritual, epistemological, legal. And they don't actually give an answer right there, but Rabbi Soloveitchik offers an answer from an itinerant preacher. He says, we have a test that we can do, right? You can take boiling water, bring this being in, pour water on one head, boiling water that hurts, and then look at the other head. If the other head cries out, it's one person. If the other head does not cry out, then it's two different beings. And that, he answers, is the answer to whether we are still a people. As long as you and I, Shai, and anybody else who's part of our people, as long as we cry out in pain, especially when others are attacked for being part of our family, then we are a Jewish people and the organism is working.
And we're going to get to the organism is working. But before that, I do want to highlight that, especially in the past 20 months, we've seen many Jews who, they don't feel any pain when the other head receives the scalding water. How did we get to a point where, unfortunately, a growing number of Jews don't feel that peoplehood?
Yeah. So I would, and I'm sure, Shai, you've experienced this, especially because of your like really visible campus activism. I was told by somebody at Columbia, I don't know if it's true, but someone said to me last year, I've been there different times with students, that I think they said like 30% of those who identify as Jewish on campus are non or anti-Zionist. I don't know if that number is true.
I think it's probably 30. It's a very self-selection, you know, they tend to jump on.
Those who identify as,
Well, those who answer the surveys are either ones who really, really care about their Jewish identity or really, really care about being an anti-Zionist.
Right. Yeah. Right. So to me, Shai, when you ask how did we get here, I actually think we should have expected this. Like, I'm not surprised by this at all. I'm not surprised by the anti-Zionists. I'm not surprised by the non-Zionists, and those are different. I'm not surprised. I mean, historically, again, if we go back to even like Hanukkah, like a classic example people can remember, Hanukkah wasn't Jews against Greeks, right? That's like almost like the wrong way of telling the story. It was Jews who believed in Jewish sovereignty against Hellenized Jews who had the backing of the Greek Empire, who wanted to stamp out Judaism. So I think there's something very, very human about when you have a minority that's being demonized in many ways, that some people will think they can get get out of jail free card by kind of like going against their people. For some people, I think it's cynical, and some people become true believers. It's really hard. Like, we know that it's really hard to stand up and look at the world and say we're a small minority and all the member countries in the UN are wrong and only a few are. There's something that takes, it's really, really hard to stand up against the world. It's hard.
It's almost like, now that you're saying that, it makes me think that, go back to the two-headed person. It's almost like the person pouring the boiling water is now the world testing, and a way for one head to persevere is to pretend that they're not feeling any pain.
Mm. Mm.
Because if they will, then they will also get the boiling
right.
water.
Right, they might be targeted. Mm. Yeah, yeah. And just going back to the Bible here, but the ancestor of the Jewish people, Abraham, right? So he is called Avraham Ha'ivri, Abraham the Hebrew. And the rabbis in the Talmud, they're like, what does this mean? There's like no Hebrew back then. It's anachronistic. And there's one opinion that is beautiful and very important for us to remember right now that says Ivri, in that context, wasn't describing where he was from or where he spoke. It was describing an act of standing apart. The entire world stood on one side, and Avraham and Sarah and their family stood me'ever on the other side. It took great spiritual strength and courage and chutzpah for Abraham and Sarah to believe in the one God in a world where idols and paganism was the norm. So that's built into our DNA, into our spiritual DNA, that we are going to need to confront majorities of people who speak up using moral and intellectual language. And we are going to need to continue to reach into the reservoir of strength of our ancestors and understand that to stand apart, even if we are small, that's how history was written.
Yeah. And I like the standing apart. It's not standing above or below, but apart.
100%.
So, you know, so obviously as a professor, as a... I focused obviously on the negative, but the reaction of most Jews post October 7 was the positive, was the surge in peoplehood rather than the pushing away of that peoplehood. And you've been studying that. Tell me about the surge.
Yeah, so the surge is a term that researchers who worked, you know, with JFNA, it was commissioned by JFNA. They came up with this surge, with this term, the surge, to describe the huge number of Jews that they found, you know, carrying out surveys, who expressed for the first time that they wanted to be more engaged. They wanted to do more learning. They wanted to have more friends. They wanted to just step up. They pointed, again, depending how you break up the poll, but in many cases you could speak comfortably of like 40% of American Jews. Who wanted to be more engaged. They carried out another study recently that confirmed the surge is still strong, a little bit lower, but still strong. And there's still this amazing awakening. And Shai, the first thing I want to say is like, whenever I look at these numbers and whenever I travel and learn with people, I just think our people are magnificent. Like,
but isn't this weird, especially for someone from the outside looking in, would say this people have just experienced probably a generational defining trauma,
yeah,
a multi-generational defining trauma, and yet 40% their reaction is, I want to be more involved with the people rather than less involved.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, we there are some who want to be less involved, to be honest here, but yeah.
How do we explain that? How do we explain that not just to ourselves, but to the world?
I don't know if I feel like I need to explain it to the world.
not in a negative way of explaining ourselves, but in a curiosity the world wants to understand. You know, rabbis are talking about conversion rates going up.
Yeah.
People wanting, you know, I have a friend who has been thinking about it for many years. October 7 was the push that made her finally make the decision and convert.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it has been, I think October 7th showed people a lot of like hypocrisy from the outside world. So when you see brokenness and moral bankruptcy and hypocrisy, it almost makes you want to go to like a place that you think stands up for truth. I also think there's like a lot of my students who tell me like, I don't feel so comfortable anymore in some spaces. So that leads to a desire to want to be with people that they don't need to explain why they feel a certain way. But I have seen, Shai, what I have seen the most from my vantage point has been not just a desire to be with other Jews, but a desire to learn Torah. I have the great privilege of teaching thousands of people in person. I have a Substack right now called Committed, by the way, in which I send out a weekly op-ed kind of like on the Parsha of the week, the Torah portion of the week. And I engage with thousands of people from around the world who like write things in. And many of them weren't learning Torah before, you know? So there is an awakening there that basically I think has like shaken up a certain apathy. And I'm going to say here shallowness that we used to have in the American Jewish experience. And when you go through trauma, you want depth and you want the kind of wisdom that is not Pollyannish and like self-helpy. And, you know, you want primal wisdom. Wisdom that helps you understand why the world seems to be spinning. Wisdom that lets you imagine your ancestors going through similar things. And wisdom that tells you that you have the strength to be great as well if you stand on the shoulders of your ancestors and your tradition. And you don't need to believe in God or believe the Torah is from heaven, which I do, or believe that the Talmud should tell you how to live your life, which I do. You don't need to believe in any of those things to look at them as sources of tremendous spiritual wisdom and guidance right now.
And this ties into, you know, the Torah learning. And this is interesting because for me as an atheist Jew, I still feel the need. This was the first year of it. I read Megillat Esther in Purim on my iPhone, you know, scrolling at night. But because you wrote some place which I thought was almost controversial. Mm. You wrote, Jewish pride is not enough.
Mm, yeah.
And at a time when I can tell you, when I ask people, what kind of a Jew are you? The number one response is, I'm a proud Jew. Mm. And yet, what do you mean by Jewish pride is not enough?
Yeah, I'll tell you where that came to me, Shai. When Pew has had some studies of American Jews out. And if you look at their two studies in 2013 and 2020, they show tremendous kind of like breakdown in terms of Jews who do Jewish things or who are raising Jewish children. They just saw like a decrease in Jews who are who have Jewish friends or who are giving Jewish money. So basically the word, and it's a complicated word for academics, but like you could argue that you saw a lot of assimilation. And I recall speaking with some colleagues and some of them would say, okay, lots of assimilation, but don't worry. The statistics on Jewish pride are through the roof. We have over 95% of American Jews who are proud to be Jewish. So why care if they don't know the, you know, where they come from or what it means to be a Jew or you know, don't worry.
What are we proud of if they don't know?
Yeah. And what shook me, Shai, is that I was actually doing a survey then of like literature on ethnic groups in America. So I was studying literature on like Italian Americans and like Polish Americans and Irish Americans.
And they tend to be very proud of who they are.
Yes. But the scholars, this is the interesting thing, they show pride as like the last stop in the journey.
Where's the journey going?
The ethnic journey before you completely leave it behind. So it's almost like pride, it's like you used to live with fellow Irish American, you used to have certain jobs, you used to know your grandmother's recipes, you know, it used to matter to you a lot. And then it's like today you, on St. Patrick's Day, once a year, you go and you raise a pint and that's what it means to be Irish and proud. But give it a generation and that will be gone as well. So it's almost like the research pushed me to think of Jewish pride, that it could have the danger of being the last step. If we don't know, so I believe in Jewish pride that is based on knowing what we are proud of. Again, I'm not bashing people. I'm not saying don't be proud, but I'm saying there is a difference between saying I'm really proud to be Jewish and not knowing to answer why that is. And between saying I am carrying with me a history of 4,000 years. Abraham and Sarah are my ancestors. I am standing here because our ancestors survived the Inquisition, they survived pogroms, not just survived, they flourished. They built up so much of Western intellectual history and literature and invested in the arts and medicine and made the desert bloom. And what I stand for is extraordinary. When you have that sense, like that sense of, it's not just pride, it's confidence. It's walking into any room. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks had this of blessed memory. You could see that the dignity that he would walk into any room, in any setting, no matter how sophisticated, intellectual, elite, Queen of England. And he's standing there as somebody who knows that what he represents, right? Not in terms of being superior, but in terms of like, wow, I have this treasure. And I think that when you have that, that pride is confident and powerful in a way that cannot be replaced. And I hope that all of them, what I think we need to do is not to be like telling each other, don't be proud, you know, but actually inviting and saying, you're proud, amazing. Let's make sure this is not the last step, okay?
There is an optimistic twist on this, I would say, which is a lot of times people refer to the persecution of Jews in racial terms, like just like racism. But in many ways, the persecution of Jews is more like homophobia, because for most Jews, and I'm not talking about Orthodox Jews, but for most Jews, it's an potentially invisible identity. We can hide our identity. You know, you can, you know, if I tuck my Magen David, most people wouldn't know that I'm Jewish. If you could say I'm just wearing a skirt because I like wearing a skirt, and I'm no, you blend in, quote unquote. But in the same way, just like gay pride is taking something that's potentially hidden and making it visible, Jewish pride can create that. It can be the last stop in the path, but it can also be the first stop of, now that we show our pride, now that you wear your Jewishness on your sleeve, it forces you to do.
Yeah, I love that. I haven't thought about that before, like the distinction that you're making between kind of like racism and homophobia. I think 100%, I think that's kind of like the project of our lifetimes. If we are able to approach this moment with all of its darkness and build something.
Because for me, I can tell you, and maybe this is just anecdotal, but once I started wearing a Magen David, Star of David, all of a sudden, my interactions with other people have changed, Jews and non-Jews, because my identity is out there. It's a reminder. So other Jews react to me, not just as Shai Davidai, but as Shai Davidai, a Jew. And non-Jews react to me as, you know, a representative of this people. So I would say lean into your pride, but know why.
Yeah.
Or keep asking yourself.
Yeah, 100%.
So before we end, I do want to ask about one other thing, and we kind of mentioned it and glossed over before, but you know, on your website, you say, one of my values is build bridges, not walls. Mm. And you build a lot of bridges. But one bridge that I think you build incredibly inspiringly well is orthodoxy or religiosity and feminism. Mm. And so you are a Rosh Kehila. What is a Rosh Kehila?
It's a title that we came up for my position in my community, in which I serve as
this. And literally means?
Oh, literally means the head of the community. And it indicates that I serve as a spiritual leader and that I teach Torah and guide the community.
And why is that so groundbreaking?
Yeah, it's funny, Shai. As you might sense from my body language, I'm like resistant to like the groundbreaking label.
That's why I'm here. You gotta push you to own up it. Own
right,
up to it.
But actually, the reason I'm resistant is because I want to argue it's not groundbreaking. Like I want to argue that this is like that to be I'm a traditional Sephardic woman who follows traditional Jewish law, who affiliates with Orthodox communities. I believe in traditional Jewish law and I follow it in my life in many, many ways. And from what I've learned, Jewish law, and also God, Hashem wants all of us to serve our people. And Hashem sees in all of us, no matter our gender or where we come from, tremendous potential to do good in the world. And I have been blessed with the opportunity to teach Torah in a way that aligns with my commitment to Jewish law, and in a way that I just don't want it to be groundbreaking, because I believe this is the way it should be. And I think I don't want to have the binaries, you know, in which you have, you know, egalitarianism and no Jewish law, and in which, like, I just don't want to have those binaries. And I everything that I do, Shai, I'll just tell you, I am always thinking that I am my grandmother's granddaughter. She was like this like little Haredi woman, didn't graduate high school, wouldn't speak in front of men, like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, had 9 children, hundreds of descendants. And everything that I do, she wouldn't agree with a lot of what I do. I'll just name that here. And that's like, we can talk later about family dynamics.
Oh, don't even start me about my safta.
Right. So my abuelita. but I remind myself that after 120 years, I want her to be proud of me. And I am trying, sometimes we make mistakes, to pave a path in which individuals, no matter where they come from, can serve God. And I believe in Jewish law. I believe in obligation. I believe that I've inherited wisdoms that have allowed Jewish communities to maintain a sense of religious richness and, you know, that connects me and you, even if you don't observe it, all the way to Sinai. Mm. So, yeah.
I love that. And for people that listen and might have an issue, not an issue, but a reaction to the statement, God wants you to serve all of us to serve the Jewish people. The way I translate it in my mind is the Jewish people want all of us to serve the Jewish people.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll say here, Shai, is that I don't assume, you know what, I'm going to say it a little bit differently. The God you reject might be the God I reject also.
We can talk more offline. I don't reject any God.
But I'm saying, like, atheists, I'm like, often I have a conversation with atheists or secular people, and when they describe why they don't believe in God, I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm with you. Mm. I don't believe in that either. Right, so I think there's conversations that we can have around what we mean by all these terms.
So we'll have to have you back and have that conversation.
Yeah.
Before we end, we're going to do what I call the Here I Am lightning round.
Okay, cool.
A series of rapid fire questions. There's no right or wrong answer. Just the first thing that comes to mind. Michal Biton, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I can be an introvert.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
They don't know that we are multiracial, multi-ethnic, all over the place.
When was the last time you cried?
Last night, when we read the news about Israel attacking Iran, and just feeling this sense of living in historic and consequential times, and just feeling so much love and fear for my people in Israel.
Love and fear. If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
I think right now, not original, but David Ben-Gurion. I would love to speak with him.
You're the second person only in this show to have mentioned David Ben-Gurion. Mm. The first person was Johnny Daniels. Why?
I read this biography of him called A State at Any Cost, which is brilliant. And he just had this visionary chutzpah of believing he can change the world when, like, the whole world was against him and things were not going to go according to his way. And I want him to teach us how to do it right now.
What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
They're all good. I love Passover, the Torah of Passover.
So this is going to be tough, but what is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
It's like I have bad, like, people won't like my answer, but I struggle with Purim, with the observance of Purim. The Megillah story I love, the observance.
But you have a problem with the alcohol?
I don't know, like the presents, the mishlochem manah, it's just like it's always very, as a Jewish mammal, so it's always a bit overwhelming and yeah.
When do you feel safest?
That's a good question. I think probably with family and close friends who see me.
When do you feel least safe?
When I go on Twitter, I had to break away from Twitter. I used to like really read a lot. And now I just notice my anxiety spiking in a way that no other experience makes it spike.
What gives you hope?
Honestly, I just meet with so many Jews who give me hope. Whether it's, again, like what Israel carried out last night and they're attacking Iran. I mean, when this comes out, we'll see what happens. But like the brilliance, the audacity. Or just like, speaking of Colombia, I spoke at the Jewish student affinity group graduation from the social work school. And just meeting those students who their general graduation was protested. And seeing their pictures, they walked with like a Jewish graduate kind of like big sign. And seeing that they built this amazing community, they started their program not thinking that they were doing it as Jews and leaving it like energized and also still committed to the world and to doing good in the world for others. I'm just like blown away.
They enrolled as individuals and they graduated as Jews.
As a community of Jews. Yeah.
Finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in large. Where would you want listeners to donate to this week?
I don't have like the name in front of me, but I like donating to organizations that are supporting families of fallen soldiers. I just don't know the name by heart, but that's the place. I think we owe a debt of gratitude we can never repay, and we need to make sure we do not forget the continuous sacrifice.
Michal, where can people find you?
Thanks, Shai. I'm on Instagram, not as much as others, but I'm a little bit there. Just my name, Michal Biton.
MijalBiton.
Yes. You can find me on Substack. I'm growing my Substack. It's called Committed. You can find me there. You can look up the podcast that I co-host with Noam Weissman called Wandering Jews with Michal and Noam.
And notice, Wandering Jews with an O, as in wander, not as wander.
Yeah, my accent makes that deaf. But love to hear from you.
And Downtown Minyan?
We go to our website. I have a website. The Minyan has a website. You can email us, contact us. We'd love to hear from you.
All right. Well, this has been a pleasure. Extremely fascinating. A lot of things to think about. Especially as recording this before Shabbat. And I'm just glad to say, here I am with Michal Biton.
Thank you, Shai. Thanks for having me.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, here I am.